What's the difference between brokenness and repentance? I've written a column in the Latest Issues Etc. journal titled Personal Brokenness. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Alfonso Espinosa writes about being raised a nominal Roman Catholic and finding the saving gospel in the Lutheran Confession. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Okay, so you have been in the grocery store and you have seen the mother with the shopping cart, and it's full of groceries, but it's also full of children. She's got maybe two up at top and maybe one in down below, and maybe there's another one that is tagging along or helping mom with the shopping. You've seen that and you've started to count heads, haven't you? And you've said, what in the world has she been up to? Why does she have so many kids? Are all those hers? Doesn't she know when to stop? What about her husband? You've had those thoughts, haven't you? Or maybe you've been one of those people to walk up and say something like, you know what causes this, don't you? Where does this attitude come from against large families? That someone is either, well, someone is either crazy or an overachiever when they do something like this. We're going to be talking about maternity, large families in literature. Rebecca Curtis joins us. She's a pastor's wife and mother of seven children. She has a master's degree from Concordia Seminary. She's co-author of the book Ladylike, Living Biblically, and author of a recent column for Touchstone Magazine titled Birthing Room, Maternity in Literature and Our Need to Find Better Words for Large Families. Rebecca, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hello, thank you.
You say that conventional wisdom knows of two types of big families, the train wrecks and the weirdos. What do you mean by this?
These are kind of the stereotypes that I think big families fall into for the general population. You've got the idea that if you hear somebody has a lot of kids, they're probably either a mess, you know, the kids are all dirty and everybody yells at each other all the time and they're really not taking care of business, or they're these weird, perfect people who do everything right and they homeschool and everybody's hair is always combed and they're brilliant and they play all the sports and play all the instruments and are these spectacular humanoids that no one else could ever attempt to be. And so that explains why normal people are excluded from both of those things. They want to live better than the train wrecks, and they know they can't live up to the weirdo standard.
When did this idea of procreation, because that's really at the heart here of how we view large families, when did procreation as a positive good in the Christian mind begin to be questioned?
I think actually a long time ago. It's always been difficult to have children. That's part of the curse, and everyone feels that, experiences it in their own lives, no matter how it plays out, whether it's that you have a lot of children or you don't get as many as you wanted or you don't get any, there's kind of no good way. And the difficulty that comes with procreation is a cross that we all bear. I don't read a lot of John Calvin because I'm a Lutheran, but I happened to be reading something not long ago in which he says that normally, outside of God's promise and God's help, having a lot of children would be a terrible curse. It is because we have the hope of the Lord that we experience that as a blessing. And that's something that Scripture does have to teach us. Our normal experience tells us this is rough. It doesn't seem like it goes very well. And so that's an example from the Reformation era of people experiencing childbearing as a difficult thing. But it especially comes to a head at the early part of the 20th century when the Anglican Church at its formal convention said, you know, there are times when Christian couples are justified in taking steps to limit their family size that aren't strictly natural. And the Roman Church, Pope Paul VI, then had an encyclical where he also says, look, we know that although children are a blessing, that there is a lot of hardship and pain and suffering built into that. And that's why the Roman Church has the position it does on natural family planning and saying that, you know, when there isn't a good solution, this is kind of something you can do to deal with whatever you need to do to make life work for everybody involved. So it's a pain that people have felt from the very beginning. It's built into our sinful condition, but the way we have dealt with it really changed at the beginning of the 20th century when it began with what are now mainline Protestants and then kind of trickled down into the more Catholic, small-c Catholic position that the Roman Church ended up taking on it, to the point that now the default position of most Christians is not much different from what we see in the world, where deciding how many kids you're going to have is just the normal way to live, and it's not really something that we even consider an ethical issue, and to say otherwise can really raise people's hackles, and that's when this conversation starts getting very difficult.
Why did you choose to address this issue by looking at some pieces of literature? Why is literature a good framework for discussing this?
That is because this conversation gets so difficult. Literature, you know, all the humanities are a laboratory for the human spirit. They allow us to study things that we don't have in our own personal lives necessarily, but to, in a sense, even kind of run experiments on human beings in ways that don't hurt them. So we see art does that, fine art, I mean, and music does that by manipulating people's emotions, and literature does that by actually inventing human subjects and saying, what would happen to this kind of person in this kind of situation, and if these were the people around that person, and if these events took place in this context? And so under the question of how we relate to big families and to having children, literature can be really helpful because it allows us to do that study without using personal examples, without using ourselves as examples or our friends or our family members. Anybody who's stumbled into a conversation like that knows it pretty much can't go well because people immediately feel judged and misunderstood, and it becomes really impossible to have, you know, kind of an intellectual or spirituality-based discussion because people cannot help taking it personally, which totally makes sense. So if you read a book or read a story where people are dealing with these questions, it allows us to take a step back ourselves while still thinking about these ideas in a way that doesn't hurt us or another real-life human.
We're talking about maternity, large families in literature. We'll get into the literature itself with Rebecca Curtis after the break.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We'll just add another limb to the family tree.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about maternity and large families in literature. Rebecca Curtis is our guest, co-author of the book Ladylike, Living Biblically, and author of a recent column for Touchstone Magazine titled Birthing Room, Maternity in Literature and Our Need to Find Better Words for Large Families. Rebecca, what three pieces of literature are we going to talk about and why these three?
The first book that my article discusses is called The Pastor's Wife. It is by Elizabeth von Arnim, and I kind of stumbled into it myself. Naturally, it caught my attention because I am a pastor's wife, and I also like the author, and I thought, oh, well, this will be good. And this is a novel that kind of tells the story that aligns with conventional, contemporary thinking on what would go into having a big family. It's the story of a married couple. The guy's a pastor. He's actually a worker priest, kind of interesting, in Prussia around 1900. And things don't go very well for them. They take the children God sends as God sends them, but they kind of have the bad experience that we've been taught is normal. The second novel that my article discusses is a series of four novels. It's about a family that emigrates from Sweden. I think the whole series is called The Immigrants. It's written by Wilhelm Moberg, and it was written in the 1940s and 50s, but it's set in the 1850s and following. And it also follows the story of a family, and in that family, you know, this is just the normal setting for families. You're at that time period, you're married, you take the children who come your way. There's not a whole lot to be done about it under normal circumstances. And that family's experiences are more what you expect from a couple who are kind of both on the same page about things. Not necessarily that, you know, they had this deep, beautiful soulmate relationship, but just that they accept hardships as they come and that they're a unified front. The third novel that my article discusses is by Enid Bagnold. She's the author of National Velvet. She's famous for that. But she had kind of noticed that most literature doesn't spend a lot of time on what it's like to actually have a baby, to be pregnant, to give birth, and then to recover and to, you know, kind of show a baby around and how the world works. And she was a mother of four herself. Throughout her pregnancies and her postpartum recoveries, she took really close notes about just how things were for her, for the baby, for the rest of her family, what was going on in her head. And her novel, The Squire, grew out of those notes. So it's very interesting just that it was such a long-term project for her as a writer. But also, the story that she tells is very beautiful, and it's not sentimental. It's not rose-colored glasses. It's also can be almost kind of uncomfortable to read. It's very forthright about what all of those physical experiences are like. But it is a surprising view, I think, to contemporary readers, because we have been told having a fifth kid at the age of 42 is a nightmare. That is not how you want your life to go. It's going to be so hard. It's going to be bad for your health. It's going to be rough on your marriage. It's not fair to your other kids. And that is absolutely not the story that she writes. What she shows is a woman who is very satisfied with her work, that she takes a healthy pride in it, and that she does truly receive this child as a blessing and enables her other children to do so as well. So that's kind of it. These three pieces of literature as a whole kind of tell the whole story. Things not going so well, things going as well as we can hope for them to under the cross, and things going in a very blessed way that people also experience. I think we forget that when we do want to be faithful to the theology of the cross, knowing that life is characterized by the suffering that our pain causes, that we still experience so much good. And the Lord very often gives his people so much. Our cups run over. And that's the story that the Squire tells.
So let's go back and do a little more detail on each one of those, beginning with the pastor's wife.
The pastor's wife is, like I said before, this is the story we've been told to expect, that if women don't have access to contraception, they just become these miserable doormats in society, and no one cares about them. They're just baby machines. No one takes seriously their health concerns, the bad things that happen to them, no one cares about, and no one addresses. That's kind of the situation that the protagonist in that story deals with. She and her husband simply don't communicate well with each other. They come from very different places in life and have different outlooks as a result, and don't really ever talk about it and never figure out a way to do that. And when a lot of tragedy comes their way relating to all the children they've been given, they're just not in a position to handle it. Things get worse and worse for them. They're in this downward spiral of misunderstanding and loneliness and anger and feeling abandoned. And finally, when the wife is told by a doctor that she really has to stop having kids or she will face serious health consequences or even die, she asks the doctor, "Will you please tell my husband this, because he won't take it seriously from me?" So the husband goes in, the doctor tells him this, and the husband, you know, kind of doesn't know what to do with it and says, "Well, effectively, our marriage is shut down. I mean, we'll keep living in the same house and we'll raise the children we still have." But, you know, they just kind of, that is basically the end of their relationship, you know, in any in any normal social way. And so, you know, that's kind of, I think, what people consider, like, how could you avoid this if you have that many kids? You know, it's not going to go well. It's just so difficult. And that's why we avoid it. We're afraid of that happening. And I think for people who have been there, for people who have received a lot of children, that if reading that story can be very difficult, because it very faithfully portrays a lot of the hard things that will come up along the way. And they're not things you can really talk about with anyone who's not in the same place you are, because anyone who is outside of that is going to say, well, just quit having kids. Then you won't have all these problems. And that's not helpful. And it misunderstands where those couples have begun in the first place as far as how they approach their marriage. So this is a novel that allows us to kind of look in at a situation like that, and it in a way that is not voyeuristic to real people, that doesn't hurt them or cause further damage to their relationship or their family, and allows us to kind of develop a sympathy for them that could be helpful in some way and allow us to serve them rather than just yelling at them for making what we consider to be bad choices.
What viewpoint of family procreation do we find in that series, The Immigrants?
This is kind of the, you know, what we think of maybe as the default setting of kind of our ancestors, that you get married, and by golly, married people normally end up having kids. That's the way nature works. And although the characters in that series are accepting of that, and they are, you know, they never are resentful of their children or, you know, speak negatively about that, it's still very much a source of anxiety and stress to them. The first novel in that series is when they actually make their immigration, and the wife is pregnant on the transatlantic trip, and she's just miserably ill. And, you know, as they, back in the old country, they had problems with baby having. They have their problem on their trip when they are, you know, making their way across North America to the place where they're going to land. It continues to just be something they have to factor into their lives, that she could be pregnant anytime, or she's pregnant now, or she's going to give birth, and we hope that goes okay, and we can have that attended properly. We hope the baby's going to be okay. We hope she recovers okay. With all of those, you know, with none of the medical advantages that we have now, but in the perspective of these people, you know, representative of their time, I think, they understand that it's part of the bargain, that the blessings of marriage and the blessings of children also come with crosses, and that does not allow either party to a marriage to mistreat the other in accordance with their wedding vows, and that it is a cross they bear with grace, and that they support each other in it, despite the fact that they don't necessarily always understand each other's perspectives, and even figuring out what to do with, you know, problems that you can't explain away. You know, there are material problems of health and provision and human relationships that have to be figured out under those circumstances. But that is their circumstance, so they accept it and also lead godly lives according to it.
So you mentioned this in passing before, but there were attempts for the church to reconcile God's view of procreation with the conventional wisdom, usually in favor of the conventional wisdom. Go into a little more detail about that among the Anglicans and then at some point Catholics.
Sure. So, you know, the position that we find ourselves in today as Christians is, you know, grows out of all of that. And, you know, you can kind of see, you can really kind of see these novels being cited as evidence in these, you know, as people are debating these things and considering them, well, what do we do with Ingeborg and Herr Pastor Dremel? What do we do about a terrible situation like that, where she's a physical wreck and they've had these terrible things happen with her children, and he is insensitive and they don't know what to do? What are you, how do you help those people? And I think what happened in the Anglican Church is they said they've just got to be let off the hook. It is more than the human spirit can bear, and so, you know, we need to allow room for Christians to exercise discernment in this, and when there is a very dire situation, they shouldn't be condemned for taking steps that, you know, for using devices or pills or whatever. The pill hadn't been invented then yet, but that's, you know, what it turned into. We have to allow for this, or people are going to break. The Roman Church then, you know, can't admit the use of contraceptives, artificial contraceptives, in the way that the Protestant churches do. So they come up with allowing for deliberate abstinence during the times in a wife's cycle when she can't get pregnant, as well as that can be determined. And I say, you know, if that's what you need to do, it's an okay thing to do. Of course, it becomes kind of, the way that we then end up perceiving that is, I particularly learned this from a friend who grew up some kind of non-denominational person and married a Roman Catholic guy, and then they went to counseling at his church, and that included this marriage retreat weekend where a couple with, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 kids taught the unit on natural family planning. And of course, my friend came back from this and said, well, that's just silly. If they said that it works so well, but then why do they have all those kids? And from the other angle, it's, well, if it's fine to use natural family planning, why isn't it fine to use other kinds of contraception? So, you know, people really struggle to get their minds around that. And if you are in a church that kind of has done as the Missouri Synod has done, which was just kind of backing off from the question sometime in the 50s or 60s, you kind of don't know where to go. You know that this is what the Roman Catholic Church officially teaches, but you also know that you don't know a single Roman Catholic who lives that way. You know that there is also on the other side of Protestantism these people who, you know, all dress weird and have a million kids and really avoid society as much as possible, it seems like, and we don't really understand their perspective either. You know, some of them seem to have this almost militant view of growing their own personal armies to begin a new crusade or something like that. And we just have very little frame of reference for a healthy and faithful view of what family life looks like within a Christian ethic under the cross that doesn't kind of spin into one of these either camps that doesn't make a lot of sense to us.
Rebecca Curtis is our guest. We're talking about maternity and large families in literature. We'll turn to another piece of literature, The Squire, on the other side of the break. After our conversation with her concludes, Joy Pullman of The Federalist will join us to talk about Planned Parenthood's president emphasizing abortion.
Recently graduated from high school or college and looking for a chance to serve a community in need while sharing the good news of Jesus Christ? Lutheran Young Adult Corps may be for you. Lutheran Young Adult Corps provides opportunities for long-term, full-time service for 10 weeks through the summer or 10 months over the school year in places like St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Boston. Find out more about Lutheran Young Adult Corps by finding us online at lcms.org/YACORPS or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Lutheran YA Corps.
Thank you for helping us make Budget and for more than 5 million downloads of Issues Etc. in 2018. Thanks to your support, Lutheran Public Radio has been independent and in the black for almost 11 years. You've heard us say, now only our listeners can cancel us, and we mean it. Thanks for listening, thanks for your prayers, and thanks for your financial support of Issues Etc. live and on demand, and for our 24/7 talk and music stations.
Where doctrine is life. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Greetings to you from the heart of Texas. I am Pastor Mark Knuckles, the senior pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church and School. We are the LCMS Mother Church of Austin and are situated just blocks from the University of Texas. Liturgical in worship and confessional in teaching, we are a dual parish with the only Lutheran deaf congregation in the Austin area, Jesus Lutheran Church of the Deaf. Come see what God is doing among us through His Word and His sacraments.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live, weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific. At issuesetc.org.
Talking about maternity and large families in literature, Rebecca Curtis is our guest, co-author of the book Ladylike, Living Biblically. Rebecca, one of the other pieces that you want to discuss, a piece of literature, is called The Squire. What do we find there?
I thought this book was really extraordinary. And, you know, if you are a person who for some reason has an interest in getting inside the maternal mind, this is the book for you. It is, like I said, it does not seek to make the reader strictly comfortable. You will kind of like if you visit a friend in the hospital and you see some pretty personal items lying around or know that they're going through treatments that are pretty private. You're going to see a bit of that here, but that's what childbearing is about. It is a very personal and physical matter, but it's also very forthright about the personal satisfaction and happiness that is natural to the birth of a child for a family. And very often when people talk about this, you know, immediately it's just teddy bears and fluffy rainbows and silly things and sentimental and, you know, basically like you have a baby and you just have this mad crush on it and you're basically infatuated and then, you know, life kind of goes on and then there's just, you know, you're boring normal kids and you love them to death and, you know, it's the whole ethos is governed by platitudes. This is a story that doesn't do that. It is an excellent portrayal of the human condition, which is what literature is supposed to do, and particularly in the focus of a mother who's already experienced, who already knows all the hard things and all the yucky things and all the scary things, still being truly happy, looking forward to giving birth, not in a way, not in, you know, again, not in some weird, you know, woman warrior crazy kind of thing, but just knowing that it is a real challenge and that she is experienced and that she does, in fact, have a bit of rightly placed self-satisfaction there, that after the baby is born, her love is much deeper than, you know, kind of that hormone-driven infatuation. You know, she's been there before. She's had that first baby high, and she is able to take that in a better stride and stretch it into a deeper, longer, truer thing than, you know, what you see on a greeting card written by people who, you know, will have one or two or three babies by design in their own lives, because we've kind of written this temporary understanding into our own having of babies. Like, this is something you do once or twice, and then it's over. Well, your perspective really changes if it's not something you do one or twice. It becomes a very different experience. Your fifth baby is much different than your first. And there is a depth and a richness there that is truly a blessing, because it's not something people can take for yourself. So you can want a fifth baby and not get it. If the Lord gives you one, it's because he has been exceedingly gracious.
Putting this in terms of the Ten Commandments, you say this isn't only an issue of the sixth commandment that pertains to procreation and husbands and wives, but also of the eighth commandment. Why so?
This particularly applies to the church. You know, most Christian people are more than happy to say children are a blessing and to rejoice with you when you have a baby. And at the same time, we still kind of operate under this cultural assumption that you don't overdo it, that maybe it's actually kind of selfish to have all those kids. And you're really asking for trouble. You know, you've got perfectly good kids. Why would you risk messing that up? Why would you take resources away from them to give to another kid? Why would you, you know, put that strain on your marriage of going through another pregnancy and the financial expenses of that and the health risks and the, you know, time off work and all these problems that are built into that? I think the church would serve people better if it would guard its language very carefully about that and to recognize that anytime someone tells you we're having a baby, as you yourself, Pastor Wilkin, have said, a baby is always good news. And I really appreciated when you said that and the things you said about that, and you're absolutely right. The more Christians remember that, the better they are able to serve their neighbors, to remember that, yeah, there are times when having a baby is really, really hard, and For all the reasons that I don't need to remind anyone of. But a baby is always good news, and we have the Lord's promise that he will care for us and our children, And when someone comes to us with the news that they're having a baby, regardless of how they feel about it even, it is our duty and our joy to rejoice with them, to help them rejoice, and also to, you know, to help them in any material ways that we may be able to.
Rebecca Curtis is our guest. We're talking about maternity and large families in literature. When we come back, how does the church navigate between those two things, acknowledging that raising children, raising a large family, is difficult, but avoiding the facile solution, just have fewer kids. Stay tuned.
For the kicking one inside of me, I eat for two, walk for two, live for two, now. Eat for two, walk for two, live for two, now.
How does Christianity compare with Islam, Mormonism, skepticism, Buddhism, Scientology, Jehovah's Witnesses, and other world religions? You'll find answers in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, The Christian Difference. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or learn more about The Christian Difference at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, The Christian Difference.
The Lord is our shepherd, and we are the people of his pasture. Why then do we still suffer in this life? Disease, loneliness, persecution. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm collaborating with Cheryl Swope, Molly Hemingway, and a host of literary friends in He Restores My Soul, a book that takes an honest look at hardship and heartache in light of God's promises found in his word. He Restores My Soul is now available at emmanuelpress.us. emmanuelpress.us.
Do you need a home mortgage, car, or student loan in 2019? Check out Lutheran Federal Credit Union. During January, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to their ministry of the month, Christ Community International. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU, good for you, good for the church, LutheranFCU.org.
Visiting Concordia University Chicago is a great way to open up your world. Tour our beautiful 40-acre campus, hear from current students about why they chose Concordia Chicago, discover more than 70 degree programs, and learn about financial aid and generous scholarship opportunities. Attend our February 18th visit day for high school and transfer students. Register today at cuchicago.edu/visit.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Our Savior Lutheran, Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. St. John Lutheran, San Benito, Texas. Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Snohomish, Washington. Redeemer Lutheran, Gresham, Oregon. Bethlehem Lutheran, Fairborn, Ohio. St. John Lutheran, Springfield, Pennsylvania. Zion Lutheran, St. Labore, Nebraska. Our Savior Lutheran, Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Sherman, Illinois. Christ Lutheran, Noblesville, Indiana. Calvary Lutheran, Ray, Colorado. And Trinity Lutheran, Savannah, Georgia. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Wednesday afternoon, we're talking about maternity and large families in literature. Rebecca Curtis is our guest, pastor's wife and mother of seven children. She has a master's degree from Concordia Seminary, co-author of the book Ladylike, Living Biblically, and author of a recent column for Touchstone magazine titled Birthing Room, Maternity in Literature and Our Need to Find Better Words for Large Families. In that vein, Rebecca, how does the church do two things at once? Acknowledge that raising children is difficult, that raising a large family is difficult, but avoiding that facile solution, just have fewer children.
I think, first of all, we do need to approach it as a matter of trust, to really believe it when the Lord says children are an inheritance from the Lord, that, you know, he didn't just say that to be nice. That's not God's personal baby shower card to every Christian family, and now he'll be leaving. There are times when that can be hard to see, but that's true of anything. Any gift comes with a set of expenses or responsibilities, and children are an indescribable gift here on this earth, really nothing better than that. So a gift that big is going to come with a commensurate set of responsibilities, and the difficult side of that, which is that everything we do is wrecked by sin. So acknowledging that means that taking the Lord at his word here is truly something that faith does. I think the other thing we can do is to remember that our kids are an investment, and every investment costs something up front. That's what an investment means. That when you get that news that you've got a baby coming, you just got to know, all right, things are going to be thin around here for a while. And again, a gift this size means they're going to be thin for a long while. But there is no one who ever says, nah, I wish we'd have just had fewer kids. Because once you get to that point, you can't say that. They're no longer an abstraction. They're real human beings. And no one ever wishes a human being out of existence. So regardless of how it goes, and regardless of the nature of the investment's payout, which is by no means specified or guaranteed, there is always a good to a child of God reborn at his font, and that whatever that blessing turns out to be, that we know that that's what we're working for, and that, again, we have God's promise that any child he calls by name and makes his own is a good that we should never speak ill of or discourage.
I have lately been struck by the very absolutist nature of the culture standard for what makes for responsible size of a family. My daughter just had her third child in the course of about 4 years. So she has a 3-year-old, a 1.5-year-old, and a newborn in the house.
Here comes the judgment.
Well, and the judgment is, why didn't you stop at 2? And the judgment is, you went over the national average. And,
right.
And you know, you can't have a 0.7 tenths of a child, which would put you at the average, but you went over the national average. She did not expect to encounter that kind of judgment from absolute strangers with mm-hmm. the third child. She thought maybe at the fourth or the fifth child, the judgment would kick in, but it is very strict. How do we as Christians, how would you describe this, an apologetic against what is proven to be a very absolute standard of judgment on the part of the culture about what makes for the responsible size of a family?
Yeah, this gets to be really silly because there's only one acceptable family size, and that's basically 2 kids. Because if you have 1, you'll get criticized for not giving your child a sibling. But if you have more than 2, that's really too many. So there's a pretty narrow window of being culturally acceptable. I think we don't need to make it more complicated than it is. And this is something that's kind of easier after you've got some distance from it, and, you know, I've got 7 kids, so basically no one can say anything that annoys me at this point, but I think you can just very honestly say, I love them. I love these children. I love this one, and I love number 2, and I love our 3rd baby. And I feel like anyone who wants to continue having a conversation with me at that point is just being malicious and ridiculous and also so presumptuous, because how do they know how you end up with a 3rd baby, right? There is a foolproof way, but clearly our culture doesn't really think that's on the table. Abstinence is something no one could live with. I think we just need to be honest and say, God gave me these children, and I am so thankful, and I adore each of them, and I adore him for giving them to me. And that's a beautiful witness I think we can make. They may not be in a position to receive it very well, but that's their problem.
I take a perspective on it. I think that's fantastic what you've said there. I think another thing that can be said is to kind of take a futurist view of the thing as well and say, you know, one of the things that my parents, especially my mom before she passed away, valued more than anything was that she had five boys.
You
loved,
bet.
Loved each one of them. That was considered a large family, but not an overly large family back in the, when they were having their kids. And she was one of those mothers that had the last child 10 years after the fourth one. And and it was totally unexpected. And she was 38 years old at the time. And so I'm sure she heard all sorts of stuff at the grocery store as well. But she went to her grave loving her family and thankful for many things in her life, but probably apart from the gift of salvation, most thankful that she had been given the family she was given. She never regretted it. Never, not once, even though I will tell you from being there, it was hard.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people think of babies as, you know, something, you know, another thing you can put in your house. And that's a really short-sighted perspective. These are people who will be with you your whole life. And, you know, looking down the years, I just think, oh my goodness, what are our Christmases going to be like, God willing? And looking forward to the blessings that the Lord has in store for us, and surely the crosses as well, but knowing that there are so many people to share that joy or to carry those burdens together is just humbling.
Rebecca Curtis is a pastor's wife and mother of seven children. She has a master's degree from Concordia Seminary. She's co-author of the book Ladylike, Living Biblically, and a recent column for Touchstone Magazine titled Birthing Room, Eternity in Literature and Our Need to Find Better Words for Large Families. You can find out more about her book Ladylike at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand or call Concordia Publishing House and ask for Ladylike, 1-800-325-3040. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
When we come back, we're going to talk about maybe a messaging problem with Planned Parenthood's new leadership. The new president says that abortion is central to what they do after spending, what the organization spent years telling us it wasn't. We'll be right back. Several Issues Etc. regular guests are candidates for leadership positions in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Every LCMS congregation has received nomination forms for the president and vice presidents of the synod. Please encourage your pastor and congregational leaders to fill out and return these nomination forms before February 20th of 2019. Learn more at issuesetc.org/nominations. issuesetc.org/nominations.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
Sanctifying your vocations with the Word of God. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things: the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us: broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.